Welcome to the Austin Forum Upload, the podcast of the Austin Forum on Technology and Society. I'm Jay Boisseau, the executive director and founder of the Austin Forum. And for this episode, I'm pleased to welcome back Rabbi Neil Blumhoff. Neil, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jay. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
I had such a great time when we talked on this podcast a few years ago, and I look forward to going back and revisiting some of that in this podcast in the post-generative AI era. And for our listeners, that's what we're going to talk about. Rabbi Neil Blumhoff's opinions on the role that technology and AI in particular are playing in people's individual lives and society. But first, Neil, can you give our listeners a self-introduction, including your interest in technology?
For sure. Thank you so very much. I've been in Austin for 25 years. I come from the Chicago area. I've lived in New Orleans and New York City, and I came here to really be a part of the ecosystem of the discovery phase of Austin, which has certainly been the case since I've been here, and it's going to continue for at least another generation or two. I am the senior rabbi of Congregation Agudas Achim, a congregation, a synagogue in Northwest Hills. It's a very dynamic and wonderful place, and I also participate in some of the music scene here. I produce and curate the jazz series at the Cactus Cafe at the University of Texas at Austin. I have a monthly series of jazz, and we highlight ideas of music and personality and bring a real conversation and a connection to the many people who visit and are part of that as well. And it's nice to be able to uplift the music as well. In terms of my own interest in technology, I think the idea of thinking about wisdom tradition, which is the tradition that I espouse, whether it's Judaism or another, as a spiritual technology is something very interesting, and how the ideas or the modems of technology in the workspace or in the marketplace in different places, as they intersect with and can expand our interest in wisdom technology, and how it can be a force for a better life, a value add to our lives, I think will be something that I'm very eager to talk about with you. And since we spoke, the rapid gains in generative AI and other things, I think, both open the playing field and open our imagination for what could be.
Well, that's a great setup for my first question. I also want to remind our listeners that if you're in the Austin area, you're very likely to find Neil at various civic events and technology events. I'm always pleased to see you around at these gatherings of thinkers. And so the way that I always describe you to friends is, yes, he's a rabbi for sure, but I think of him as a thinker about people, about technology and society. And so I'm very pleased to have you back on this podcast. And you set up the first question really well. It is, what do you think about people using generative AI for counseling and guidance? I'd like to know what you individually think. And I'd also like to know what the Jewish culture and synagogues think about this. And, you know, for fun, I even thought, will there ever be a Rab AI kind of technology?
Well, that's better than what a lot of people call me, which is Ribbi. So that's fun. But I'll say it's an honor to think things through with you, Jay, as it says in the book of Proverbs, iron sharpens iron. So it's really nice to be in the company of good thinkers and helps me with my own ideas as well. And I would say that if we're going to consider counseling and guidance, I think once the technology becomes to a place where, you know, we're not talking about prescribing medications, we're not suggesting that the AI would be suggesting that they do certain things in their lives which might harm them or cause them pain, I think that it has a lot of potential to be helpful. You know, it's very interesting. People say to me, well, at least your profession, the clergy, is never going to be, you know, AI'd out. And I'm not so sure that's the case. And I'm not so sure that we couldn't employ much of what is good about AI and interesting about AI in our own work in pastoral counseling. That's my personal idea. Mm-hmm. I think certainly traditions and cultures and synagogues don't move very fast because they try not to break things at all. But, you know, it's inevitable at a certain point. But I would say that they would be suspicious of that. And I think that they would think that anyone who would use that is going to be missing some of the cues of what an effective pastor does. And without speaking specifically about pastoring, Very often, I will tell you that people will come into my office to discuss issues in their lives, and I really won't say much, and they'll thank me profusely at the end for being such a wise counselor, because what they really need is just a listener. So I don't think I possess special information. I think if you can teach AI to be a sympathetic and empathic listener, I think you're actually doing a good service for people who may not be able to be in a position to work with somebody live.
Well, certainly the appearance of listening is relatively easy to code. I'm interested, though, in the ability to code in insights and guidance and wisdom. And of course, you can train a small language model directly on the writings that are fed to it as training data. And if it's a well-trained model, it can do interpretation and summarization and answer questions about that text. So I do see an opportunity here in the same way that people will have a religious book and read it on their own, having a tool that has already read those books and that can summarize and analyze seems like it might actually be not a replacement, but a really good tool in between those individual meetings. And especially for somebody who maybe is living in an environment where they can't have individual meetings with you, Neil, or with whoever their spiritual advisor is.
You know, I think that's right. And I think an additive as opposed to a replacement is really the future of it. I would say this too, Jen, I'd be curious about your idea that I'm trained, and I think any sympathetic listener is, to listen to the question that is actually being asked behind the question that is actually asked. So the intuition that somebody has to actually hear what's being said and not spit out some sort of scriptural response. Well, if you just read Psalm 81, everything will be great for you, for example, but to really hear intuitively what people are really asking. And very often, you might be familiar with a doorknob conversation. People will speak to me for 45 minutes and then they'll be leaving, put their hand on the door and say, actually, let me ask you. And that's really what they came to talk about. So the idea of being able to listen intuitively and not just respond because I've read a bunch of books, but also to allow it to be generous in listening and hearing what might not be said, I think would be an incredible breakthrough for the technology.
Agree completely, but also I would say that you have tremendous job security if that's the most important thing, because these large language models are not trained to listen for the question behind the question or the question behind that. They're currently trained very literally on text. And while there is a technique called replacement learning through human feedback, that technique isn't at the level yet of know what the person was really asking was this. It's more about the correctness of the literal response to the literal question, as opposed to, I think that person was really trying to ask you this. That is a much more difficult level of training for a artificial system, for a computer system. And it's one of the things that does make us as humans special. But so I think that is going to be a difficult part, whereas very literal questions, ask me what you really want to ask me. If you do that, I think the training based on scriptures and religious texts and the writings of religious scholars and such, that can be analyzed and summarized.
So Jay, I think then the business model is a little bit different. It may not be a pastoral example, but I get asked a lot of practical questions about how to observe holidays, what to do, questions that a particular rabbi would be asked about observances. And that, I think, an AI technology portal and platform would be great to help with that. For example, how do I celebrate Hanukkah? Or which way do I, how do I celebrate the Sabbath? A lot of those questions are very analytical questions. So I think if we got involved in this sort of thing, the Rab AI, I think that's where we would start.
And I'm just curious, have you used ChatGPT or Gemini or any of these tools and asked it those questions? My impression, not having asked those specific questions, is it would give excellent answers to those kinds of questions, because the answers must have been written in text in many, many languages, millions of times. And so the World Wide Web of training data should have great answers to those questions that gets folded into the models. But is that your experience, or have you?
It's the experiences of some of my colleagues. I still try to, have my own brain try to figure things out, and I enjoy that adventure. However, the thing, at least in Judaism and other religions and other faiths and traditions might have different ideas, is that our idea is to preserve many answers to one question. The idea is to, if you study some of the texts that are behind me, they will preserve two, three, four answers to a particular question, and they may not all agree at all. So the idea of wrestling with the texts would actually be a fascinating way of engaging Gemini or ChatGPT in a way of saying, well, I see you've asked me about Hanukkah. Here are five examples from your tradition that raise the question, and you could navigate among them and toggle to kind of figure out what's what. But having them at your fingertips is very important. And yes, I use them, not those platforms that you suggest, but there's a really great website called Sefaria, Sefaria, which is generally an electronic Jewish bookshelf, which has all of these things in one place. So you can ask a question and you can find it in many, many different texts. And it's really great.
I feel confident that the data from that has been absorbed into some training models for some LLM somewhere. But let me jump to the next question, which is, what are your concerns from a spiritual perspective about humans' increasing reliance on technologies in general, but things like AI, which can fool them into thinking they're talking to another human? In fact, there's some famous cases, including a Google engineer who was convinced that the LLM had actually become sentient, when we know that it hadn't. We know exactly how it works, but they're so incredibly good and compelling. And honestly, people can be misled and they can believe what they want to believe. Otherwise, things like astrology wouldn't exist. What are your concerns about, and there I went showing my PhD in astronomy and disparaging astrology really quickly. what are your concerns about people relying on the technology like AI from their spiritual development perspective?
You know, I think that there's a lot of good that can come of AI in terms of answering questions and being a companion, but I think you really hit on it as you asked the question. The idea of not being seen, or the idea of being replaced, of thinking that you are being seen when you're actually not being seen. The idea that I think there's an epidemic of human loneliness that exists. Mm-hmm. Short of a human touch or a human interaction where much is being shared but not spoken, I don't think that the technology is at that point. So just to be able to have somebody being able to interact with you is no different that I see than somebody playing a radio in their apartment all day, or a television, which is fine. I understand that. I'm not against that at all. But as you said, to think that that is a worthy companion of someone and that it's going to be us against the world, I think is difficult. Now, I've not used very often the guidance, the GPS guidance that talks you through the turns and things as you're trying to find something. I just hadn't done it. But I did it the other day, and then I was going to the airport with a friend who was driving, who was from Austin, who turned it on and began to navigate through my neighborhood. I find those just not helpful for a lot of reasons. And I asked them, and I said, why are you using the guidance system when you know how to go? And they said, well, I've become used to it, and I'm reliant on it. And I always think that there's some sort of traffic jam that I'll never know about, and I really want to know about it. And I thought about it, and I just, you know, and you're trading that for any sort of meaningful human interaction while we're talking, because you're going to stop talking while you're listening to the next
I see where direction. You're going.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. So you're going to choose already, knowing that you might save yourself 5 minutes or 10 minutes because of a traffic issue, but you're going to be accompanied by this GPS guidance system, then when you don't actually need it. And that gave me pause.
That's an interesting example, because as you started that story, I was thinking I use GPS all the time now and turn by turn, but I realized that, you know, I live in downtown Austin and I rarely go anywhere I can't walk. So I clearly don't use it on any of my walking routes, but I drive so little and I have so many other things on my mind, and Austin has changed so much that I realize I actually don't know my way around the city when I'm in a car as well. But the real reason I think I use it is to avoid decision fatigue. There are so many decisions we have to make in life these days. It's one of the reasons people like Mark Zuckerberg wears the same clothes every day, and other people, you know, have routines like eating the same breakfast every day, or they develop routines that are consistent to remove that as a decision point, because psychologists have really determined that there is such a thing as decision fatigue, even with too many small decisions. But in your example, the choice of using GPS meant that they were no longer engaged in the human interaction. And that definitely does seem quite negative. And I actually subscribe to Arnold Schwarzenegger's Pump Club newsletter, where he talks about mostly physical health, but also mental health and loneliness and things. And he brought up the exact topic you brought up the other day, that there is a direct relationship in people's feeling of loneliness and the amount of screen time they share, and how it is so much easier to watch TV and watch something good, frankly, on TV than it ever used to be, or put your smartphone in your hand and use it and scan the news and feel like you're connecting with the world because you're knowing more about the world. But in fact, you're not connecting with humans. You're connecting with snippets of information and news articles that may never affect you in your life. Many of the articles, not all, some of them are critically important, but I thought it was a great little reminder to don't depend too much on the devices, especially at the expense of human connection, which contributes much more to human happiness.
And I think there's a valor in getting lost, frankly. And I know that that's not something that we build into our tightly wound schedules, but I think that's why people crave the wilderness or crave moving out of an established place. And I think it's, you know, being able to have moments where you actually don't use your phone or put it down and have a sabbatical, yeah, amnesty can really help the rewiring that is inevitably taking place for all of us.
Oh, gosh, I realize that even though I have started putting down my phone more and taking it with me a little bit less when I walk out of the house, even I am not very good at the desire to get lost. I probably have a little bit too much of a desire to control outcomes. So maybe I should experiment with that a little bit more and get lost.
Well, Jay, my next wilderness trip, I'm happy to invite you.
Is there going to be a hot shower in the middle of this wilderness trip somewhere?
Perhaps after a couple of weeks, there'll be a shower.
let me ask you another question, and this is more in the guidance area. How do you think we should best use AI to promote things like, one, being a better person, taking care of yourself, two, being a better person in your community, being a more contributing more to other people's well-being, and three, making the world itself better? So if AI is a tool and not one we should become overly dependent on, and not one that replaces expert human guidance in all situations, how do we use it to become individually better, a better contributor in our community, and make the world better?
Those are great questions. And I think as AI continues to unfold and the possibilities are there, I think, you know, both the best and the worst will be apparent to us. And I think being able to help each other succeed and to use AI in a way that can leverage our own human presence with others, maybe, as you said very beautifully, allowing it to make decisions so we can actually concentrate on better decisions or mm-hmm. better moments together. For example, I could see, you know, meals being prepared or menus being made or grocery lists being made mm-hmm. that actually bring us into closer proximity with the people that we want to be with in our lives. I think in terms of community, I think there can be a lot of ways that people can plug in, regardless of economic situations or locations, to allow people to be able to learn or experience together. You know, during, I know we're not talking about the pandemic right now, but certainly that was a game changer for many people because it accelerated some of this work, at least in my community, where everything went online immediately, which we'd sort of been dragging our feet on, and we had gotten requests for it and we just didn't do it. And now it's all there and people send me notes regularly, even now, from vast and far flung places saying, we saw you, or we were traveling in Austin, or I was in Austin 20 or whatever it might be. And the way to connect in that way. And I think that that kind of AI technology is just going to continue to improve. In terms of the world, I think I love your example about scrolling through the news and thinking that we're part of the world. But what about if we could actually make meaningful changes for ourselves when we see things like our carbon footprint or our climate work or the things that we've done to make things better. I think that those things could be, just like we keep track of our food menus or a food log, we could keep track of our climate log or other things that will allow us to recognize that we can make things happen, or we can adopt places mm-hmm. and see them in real time and see how our investment is helping. We can see that, you know, we're places in our beloved city that would benefit from things that we could do that we wouldn't bother to do today because the traffic is so bad to get there. So I think it would allow us to connect in many ways in a more grand style, with more solidarity and in more accurate ways that would leave us space to be able to be the blessings that we want to be for each other without having unnecessary details get in the way.
I love all of that. I'm gonna bounce a few ideas off you now and tell me what you think of these. For the self, I've been thinking a lot lately about how AI can really help you with self. And certainly I would love for all of the data in my life, while protected for privacy reasons and whatnot, but be fed into a model that is trained by experts in health, in wealth, in happiness, et cetera, so it can observe negative patterns, behaviors, habits, starting before they become too entrenched, and give me that guidance. And it's, you know, sometimes you need a friend to tell you to snap out of it and do X or Y or whatnot, but sometimes they won't do that because they don't want to insult you. You're a grown up, you know, can make your own decisions, et cetera. I sure wouldn't mind having something that just nudges me a little bit and points out anything. Oh, your blood pressure's been going up a little bit, and I noticed that you've been eating some saltier foods lately. You might want to dial back on that or something. Just things that can more continuously support you and help you be better individually. And another is learning. A lot of people tell me that they really like learning from YouTube videos, but I've noticed that I really like learning from ChatGPT and Gemini, that it is, because it converses in a human language way, you don't find yourself having to search for information quite the same way as you search for it in Google or Bing. You can use more natural language, and it interprets that and it phrases the response in natural language instead of giving you a page where the answer is somewhere on that page. So it's conversational learning. And when you turn on the audio interface for the ChatGPT app on your iPhone, for example, it's almost like the movie Her, the Spike Jonze movie from 11 years ago, in which he talks to his AI. They call it an OS in the movie, but it's an AI. And you can do that now with ChatGPT. And as long as you understand what it's good at, what it's accurate at, what the shortcomings are and the possibility of hallucinations, it becomes a very powerful learning tool and sounding board for practical things. Not a replacement for humans, not a replacement for you and I going and having a beer together somewhere and talking about some very human issue, but it is a good way to learn. I like that about it. On the community and world side, sometimes I don't know what the best way is I can contribute, but there are experts that publish ways to do it. Again, Google search can be a difficult way to figure it out, but an AI-powered set of tools that knows about me, my skills, my calendar, my interests, et cetera, and what the opportunities and methods are for contributing could guide me to help find better ways to do it. Like I organized some blood drives in downtown, and I'm happy to do it. I'm an O negative. My blood is in demand, and I try to get all my O negative friends to donate, and then everyone else I can. But it was a hassle setting these things up and talking with all the different parties. And I would have loved an AI agent that could have negotiated with the blood bank and the people who have the parking lot and the different time slots available in things like that, and just do that for me. It'd be easier to do good if there was less friction to do good. And I hope AI will help us be better citizens of our communities in the world by at least simplifying the paths and removing the unknowns and frictions.
Oh, I love that. And I really hope so. I think we are all primed to be good people, but as you said, hassle gets in the way, difficulty gets in the way, and sometimes we just don't want to, you know, have to endure all of the things that get us to that place. And if that can be abolished or minimized, I agree with you. I think there's lots of great things that can happen.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to our old podcasts now. We did it a few years ago. We did it well before ChatGPT. And I asked you a final question in that podcast, and I expected one answer and got quite another from you. I asked you if you believed that computers could achieve consciousness in the way we think of it for humans. And when I asked this question of Rabbi Neil Blumhoff, I had an expectation of an answer, and I got the opposite answer. So I'm going to ask you again for our listeners of this episode, where do you stand on the possibility of computers achieving consciousness and what that speaks to for the possibility of a soul?
It's a great question. I don't know if you have a thought that I would have the same answer or a different answer this time. But I do believe that, you know, the soul is a very interesting thing. And a lot of my colleagues would say it's the soul in the end, which is going to be the determining factor of what is human. However, I do believe that one could teach a machine to believe in something bigger and I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying I think you could do that. And I think the idea of achieving a sense of consciousness or a sense of self is very possible with a machine. And I think that the ability that one would have to open up relationships independent of, let's say, the way that machine was built is certainly within the realm of possibility. So a consciousness that would lead to a soul, that would lead to a sense of something greater than oneself, I would hope indeed that our AI technology does develop that, because
wow. Yeah.
I think that that if the machine, much like a human hubris, thinks that all it is in the world is all that needs to be in the world, I think we're all much poorer in the process. And I think that as an AI would process information, I think just like you and I would say, hey, there's a really great colleague I want you to speak to. His name is Jay. He knows a lot of stuff that I don't know, and I want you to talk to him. That a machine would have that kind of modesty and that kind of understanding to say, well, here's somebody else or something else that's been coded differently, and we could share together that way too. And I think whether you argue that that's consciousness or not, I think the ability that we have to make a network together beyond, as you said before, the literal answer, because once the secondary question behind the question comes together, I think the consciousness and the soul are not far behind.
Wow. I love that answer, and it blows my mind a little bit. And I love that you, as a spiritual leader, have the open mind and view of technology that can learn, that perhaps it can achieve that. I think all technologists agree that AI teaching itself and making itself smarter is absolutely a thing, a doable thing, and that at some point we expect it to do that routinely, potentially autonomously. And then there's questions like, what are the limits of what it can teach itself? And of course, these are all of our current methods called machine learning methods, the dominant methods in AI today, are based on learning from data, albeit still guided sometimes by human feedback, as in the case of generative AI techniques. But it's certainly the case that we can develop AIs that continue to learn and continue to learn and know more and more and accumulate more data, fold that into training, et cetera. That's all conceptually reasonable over the next decade and decades. But I still haven't formulated my own thoughts on this, Neil, since our last podcast. I did have an online book discussion during the pandemic with some friends, and I thought that maybe sentience is complexity at a level that since we don't fully understand how the human brain works, we don't understand how to describe sentience in terms of human intelligence. And so how could we explain it in terms of artificial intelligence now? But that maybe there's a threshold of complexity that we don't understand in which you transition from straight calculation to sentience. And maybe it's just because I want to believe that. I don't know.
No, and I think you're right. And I think beyond straight calculation, there's a mixture, there's a gumbo of altruism. There's a sense of generosity. There's a sense of helping someone else and celebrating someone else's success. Mm-hmm. which are difficult enough as human beings. I totally understand that. But I think if we can help our machines develop that way, that will encourage and inspire us to develop that way as well. You know, I think if we really pay attention to how a human being thinks, I think we would be ashamed of much of like what we choose, what we think about and choose not to share. But I think it is our demise if we just create computers or AI in our image. I think we're doomed. I think we need to be aspirational and imaginative to allow the machines to develop in a way that we want to be inspired to develop along with them.
I love that answer. We anthropomorphize too many things in this world. Even the way we're doing autonomous vehicles. I drive a Tesla Model Y that I bought a few years ago. I love the car. The full self-driving is not full self-driving, of course, but it's pretty remarkable. But the approach that they're taking is to try to make cars drive more like humans, even disabling LiDAR and radar and sensors like that, and depending entirely on optical. But humans didn't evolve for the perfect optical system for driving. We can't see around corners. We can't see through fog and see in pitch black darkness and things like this. So I actually don't want an autonomous car that drives like a human. I prefer one that leverages all the strengths of machines and sensors at different wavelengths and things like this so that it can be better than a human driver and then help me be a better person because we can have that conversation in the car because not only am I not listening to GPS, I'm not even worried about driving the car and we're safer for it as well. So I love the idea of not trying to make computers entirely like humans, make them better if we can. Don't build our own shortcomings into them, make them better, but teach them ethics and ground them in ethics because inherently silicon and bits don't have a moral grounding. So then there's the whole argument about what are the right ethics and morals. So I just propose, Neil, that you and I determine that. So we'll determine the ethical framework for the super AI. How about that?
Well, it is something that is very, very compelling to me. And if there was an opportunity to do something like that and be part of a team with you and others, I would jump at that chance for real.
It would be a lot of fun. I'm going to throw one curveball before the final question. So you're very into music as well, as you said in the intro. And I know you have an event at the Cactus Cafe tonight at 7 o'clock or 7:30, I think.
Correct.
Which by the time our listeners hear about this, that event will be in the past. But it inspires me to ask you, what do you think the role should be for AI in music, either in composition or performance or both? I mean, I know many musicians who bristle at the idea of AI generated music. And in fact, at South by Southwest recently at a film showing, there was a bumper about South by Southwest and all the AI content and people in the audience actually booed the bumper. This film community does not want AI to encroach on human jobs. What do you think about the role of AI in music, in creativity and performance in any aspect?
Yeah, I wonder, you know, if they're booing AI, what they would say about CGI, but that's a whole nother conversation.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, I think it's a tool like anything else. My son is a published poet. He takes a lot of effort and care in crafting things. And, you know, very often people say, well, why don't you just push this button and say, you know, create a poem in the style of X and the et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, I think there's something to it. I'm not of the camp where I'm going to try to figure out all the additives in my music before I listen to it. And if there's something I don't agree with, I'm not going to listen to it. I think there's anyone who's recorded in a studio know there's a lot of technology that does happen in that studio mm-hmm. that cannot be replicated in the real world. And I think that it's just a balance. And I think that we should celebrate human creativity and not put all of our eggs in the basket of AI convenience. At the same time, I think if it's something that helps us feel better, helps us listen, if there's, you know, whether it's music or something else or a video that allows us to develop gratitude, to develop a sense of relaxation, I think it's fine. I think it's actually should be celebrated. I think we should support live music in Austin. I think we should continue to concentrate on that as an aspect of our beloved city. And I don't think we should be fearful of the other things that develop because, as we talked about earlier, there's nothing like going out to a live music venue, hearing and seeing people improvise or present in the moment, even if it's something that they created a second ago by pushing a button, but they're still creating it. They're the carriers of it. They're the vessels of it. And I think that that will not be replicated anytime soon.
I agree. And I would also add that, you know, even these generative AI things that are creating lyrics and sound and such are learning from human artists. They're creating things that are the product of learning, which is the way humans create things. We learn, we hear other artists, they influence our style. So in some ways, you know, they're learning from human content. They're learning from human coders. They're learning from human prompters. They're producing something. And then by and large, I think a great artist is going to, even if they use one of these tools, is going to take what they get and then make it their own. It's rare that a generative AI product is perfect. Generally, an expert can make the product of almost any generative AI tool better than it is when it comes out. I'm not saying that a novice can make it better. A novice using an AI tool can rapidly create something better than their novice skill level would be. But an expert will take something out of one of these tools and be able to make it their own anyway. And then it's a human machine collaboration, really.
For sure.
You know, I'm all in favor of that.
I'm glad to hear that. I think we share that idea. There's a very, as a famous story, at least in my circle, that was told long ago when the great trumpet player Wynton Marsalis was playing a very beautiful ballad someplace in New York. And it was back in the day of the Nokia phone, you know, that Nokia ring. And somebody's phone made that ring. Right. In the middle of a beautiful ballad. And it kind of like was a big buzzkill for everybody. But the story that was told, I wasn't there, is that there was a little bit of a spaciousness that was given. And then Wynton began to fold that ringtone into the solo that he was making.
Oh, that is great.
He actually brought that, as opposed to saying that that was an intrusion, to say that this is something that was out in the world that we didn't realize, and we're going to bring it into the love story of the song that we're telling. So I think that it's, I agree with you, it's a beautiful partnership of things that can be technically amazing, but it needs to also keep in mind that we are improvisatory at nature and mistake prone, and we get in our way all the time. And that is what makes the music, music.
So well said. Thank you. Last question. It's the last question on most of my podcasts, which is, what is your takeaway point for our listeners here? In light of everything we've talked about of the role of AI in our lives and in society and the interplay of AI and humans and the possibilities for the evolution of AI and what it might become, what is your takeaway for our listeners right now? What would you like them to think about or even do after they hear this podcast?
Well, thanks, Jay. I think what they should do is continue to listen to your podcast.
Thank you.
You know, the other things would be to, and I really was struck by what you said of allowing AI to help maximize our health and to have someone, something, some mechanism look after us. So to maximize our health by using those ways of measuring blood pressure, diet, happiness, sleep, etc. The other thing would be for me is to not be afraid, is to recognize that this is an opportunity. And if we cede the creation to other people, then we're not allowing our voice to be heard. And I think that there is self-interest for sure, but anybody who knows any creation stories knows that there's more than one pathway towards creation, and that we should allow our values and our morals and our preferences to be built into how the world is seen. So we should share our things widely. We should share with each other, and we should uplift each other as we continue to walk in this world, partnering together and partnering with the technology that presents.
That is a perfect ending to a wonderful podcast. Neil, thank you for joining us again on the Austin Forum Upload. I now look forward to more and many future conversations with you.
Thank you, Jay, and thank you for your generosity.
Thanks for listening to the Austin Forum Upload. You can listen to additional episodes and check out a schedule of our monthly in-person events at austinforum.org. The Upload is a production of the Austin Forum on Technology and Society, a nonprofit organization here in Austin, Texas.